Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. 30 Minutes in the New Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other things that are living over there. Those things are podcasts. And also, you can go to the events page. And at the events page, you can find out information about our upcoming city events in Las Vegas and Houston. Houston on February 22nd and Las Vegas on March 21st. You can go to either of those events if you're in those areas for free. All you got to do is sign up. So we would love to see you there, man. Like, sign up, show up. That's how the city events work. It's going to be a good time. Also, guys, we got to say, right now, the registrations are pouring in for a conference in Hamburg, Germany. Yes, sir. If you are one of our European listeners and you would like to come hang out with Eric and Chad and Scott Keith and myself, you can do that by coming to the Great Freedom Conference in Hamburg, Germany. That thing is filling up. We would love to see some of you guys there. So you can get that information. I'll put a link in the show notes to the Germany conference. You can find information about that also on the website. We would love to see you there. Sign up for that Great Freedom Conference. We're going to be there with some wonderful friends from Germany. We're going to be talking about the freedom of a Christian, man. And I am looking forward to it.
I'm excited about it, man. I can't wait. Well, we're not just going to Germany, but we have Sweden the next week where we'll be, you know, preaching at a conference there too. And so it's going to be a lot of fun. All the wives are in tow as well. So it's going to be a party. So yeah, that's going to be exciting, man. It's a good year. It's a good year. I'm looking forward to the Las Vegas event too. And then of course, you know, here we still stand every year is like, you know, highlighted.
Yeah,
the year
I might mention that is rapidly filling up. I mean, we are selling tickets at a clip unprecedented for Here We Still Stand. I mean, I believe there are about 150 tickets left to that event total. So I mean, we always sell 500. That's what we do. We sell out, you know, every year, and so we do 500 people at that event, and there's about 150 tickets left to that. So if you want to come to Here We Still Stand, it's the time is now to get on that.
At least get the ticket, worry about the housing or the hotel and all that stuff later.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Eric, where are we now in the gospel according to Luke?
We are in Luke chapter 9, verse 18. We last left off seeing Jesus feed the 5,000 with the 5 loaves and 2 fish, and course, that remarkable miracle that's gotten so much attention throughout history. But now we move to a passage that's also gotten quite a bit of attention. Actually, maybe this whole chapter, Dan, is, I mean, a pretty remarkable chapter with all of the nuggets that we have to go through today. So not sure how quick of a clip we'll move through this today, because there's a lot to cover. And it begins this way, verse 18. Now it happened that as he, Jesus, was praying alone, the disciples were with him. And he asked them, "Who do the crowd say that I am?" And they answered, "John the Baptist, but others say Elijah, and others that one of the prophets of old has risen." Now, what this shows you, by the way, is that the crowds do recognize something supernatural about Jesus, because all of the people that are mentioned as candidates here are people that have died. John the Baptist has died. Elijah has been gone for a long time. One of the prophets of old has risen. So the people do recognize something very unique and special about Jesus.
Yeah, the two people that it mentions are interesting. You have Elijah, who, you know, is someone who didn't die, was taken up to heaven. So there's this belief that Elijah will return, right? And we've talked about this.
Especially in the Judaism of the day. But even still, if you like go to a Passover Seder today, the tradition is to leave an empty chair at the table for Elijah in case he shows up.
Right, right. And so this is why a lot of people were asking John if he was Elijah, because, well, indeed, this question is reasonable because the angel says that he is one like Elijah. And Jesus says, if you're willing to accept it, he is Elijah. Yeah. So things are very weird in that sense. So you have that. But then you have the John the Baptist thing, that people are saying that. And that's interesting, coming on the heels of what we heard last episode, which was Herod wondering if John the Baptist, whom he had beheaded, had come back from the dead while hearing about Jesus. So it wasn't just that Herod thought, well, is this John the Baptist? But people were maybe even saying, like, I think John has come back.
Yeah, yeah. And so everybody recognizes that there's something very unique about him. And obviously he's been going around doing miracles, and they have good reason to think that. And then he said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter famously answers, the Christ of God. This is the great confession. This is the great moment when Peter just spells it out plainly that you are the Messiah. That's why we're with you. We're following you because we believe that you're the anointed one that God has promised throughout all of these generations that would come.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's important to know that this is like kind of the one of the distinct times that we see this word Christ. And we use Christ interchangeably. I know I do, at least, you know, with Jesus. So I'll say, you know,
yeah, we almost use it as like a last name.
Yeah. Sometimes I just use it as a name in general, you know, I mean, I'll say, even writing, I'll say, Christ tells us, or when we look to Christ, or when we see the ministry of Christ, and we don't even bother with, you know, his name. His name is, he wasn't named Christ. Certainly he wasn't named Jesus Christ as a last name or anything like that. But this is kind of where we get this, that he is the Christ of God. And this word Christ is to state that he is the promised one, the anointed one, the Messiah of God.
Yeah, literally the anointed one or the Mashiach, you know, that's that is the word there. And you're right, it is not a word that's often used in the Gospels, and that's what makes this confession so significant, that Peter is saying, you're the one that we believe is promised from the very beginning to save the people of Israel.
Yeah, I mean, to say that you are the Christ of God is to say that you are everything that God has promised.
Yeah.
It's a huge statement.
Yeah, huge statement. And Peter is speaking on behalf of all the disciples, because the you there, when he says, but who do you say that I am, is plural. And so he's asking all of them. And Peter, of course, has become sort of the representative, you know, the leader of the pack, and answers for all of them. So they're not disagreeing. And so what you would expect, I mean, remember the expectations, even though they think he is the Messiah, they have the expectation that he is the Messiah that will go in and conquer Rome, that will finally bring Israel back to prominence, restore, and maybe even better, have a better kingdom than King David. You know, that this is going to really put Israel on the map. Rome's going down. That's the picture that Peter has in his mind when he makes this confession. So what we read next is very startling to them. Imagine being right there at that moment, great confession, and it says this, and he strictly charged and commanded them to tell this to no one, saying, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed, and on the third day be raised.
Now, this is one of the more explicit times where Jesus foretells his death, because it also comes with the rejection of the elders, the priests, and the chief priests and the scribes, to be killed, and then to be raised. I mean, you have the whole thing here.
Yeah.
The whole work of Christ, you know, is encapsulated here, which they will apparently not remember.
Yeah. Oh, they don't remember it, or even if they do, they can't really process it. Like, it just seems like the disciples, when they hear him say this, are like, "Huh, I wonder what he means."
Yeah.
And Jesus is like, "No. Like, I stutter? Like, this is exactly what I'm telling you. This is what's going to happen," and they just don't seem to be able to put, they don't have a category for this.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, just not in their thinking.
Yeah. I mean, it is a bizarre contrast. I mean, when you think about, you are everything that God has promised. You are the anointed one. You are the Messiah that was told would come, to come and deliver us, to save us. And he's like, yeah, I'm going to go die.
Yeah.
And this is like, whoa.
Yeah.
That's not
part of my plan.
But that was not part of this promise. Not as I read it anyway, which, I mean, of course, yeah, that is part of the promise, but not as they're reading it.
Yeah, Peter and the disciples have a very different plan for Jesus' life than he does.
Yes.
Than the Father does. And you see this really culminate on the last night of Jesus' life when, of course, you know, Jesus again makes this prediction that he's going to be rejected, and Peter steps up and is like, never, you know, no way. I will never let that happen. And again, it's like, no, you don't understand. Even to the point when he's arrested, Peter tries to, you know, defend Jesus and tries to fight back the guards, you know, that are arresting him, because he just doesn't understand that this actually has to happen.
Yeah, you might not pull that from this account in Luke, but one of the things that Luke doesn't have in it is sort of the pushback from the disciples, which always happens when Jesus says this stuff. You know, they'll say, by no means, or, you know, Peter will be say something like, you know, over my dead body, essentially.
Yeah, I'll never deny you.
Yeah.
That I love the fact that Peter even goes so far to say, like, these may deny you, but not me.
Yeah.
Like, he just throws his other disciple brothers under the bus.
It's a good, and this is where Jesus will call you Satan.
Yes, exactly. A little too much pride there, Peter. And so again, now, I mean, Jesus says, not only am I going to die, but actually, as my followers, you can look forward to the same. And he said to all, verse 23, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. Now, I just want to point out before we go on with the rest of what Jesus says, it is so important here to note the word daily. Because there's a tendency to think in terms of, I got saved at this moment, and then it's all different. But the reason that take up your cross daily is there is because every day we have sin that we need to die to. Like, every day we've fallen short of the glory of God. And so every day is a process of picking up that cross again. And to pick up a cross, what we're talking about here, the work here is dying to the idea that you can save yourself.
Well, it's pretty simple if you really look at it. What dies on a cross? You do.
You.
You die on a cross.
Yeah.
And what he's saying is every day that you need to die. Because a lot of times I think that we talk about this sort of thing, like, you got to kill your sin.
Yeah.
You know, like, you gotta sin has to die.
And then, the thing is, that gives you too much agency.
Yeah, man. and there's biblical stuff of that, like, you know, like, yeah, be killing sin. But what Jesus is saying here is unequivocally that you have to die. And of course, like, we're all going to die, but this is not what he's talking about. He's talking about us, like, our self-sufficiency, our ability to save ourselves, all of that has to die. Our perceived righteousness, that has to die every day. And this is seen in his follow-up, which is, for whoever would save his life will lose it. So if you are to try to save yourself, you will end up losing. But whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. And by losing, this is, it gives it up. That is, willing to die to themselves.
Yeah.
They will gain.
And where does that death first happen? Where were we united with Jesus and his cross? Well, it starts in our baptism, as Romans 6 says. And so this is why the language of taking up the cross daily is why Luther could say the life of the Christian is nothing but a daily baptism, or something where you're always remembering your baptism. What he means by that is, you're remembering that you've died to sin and now live to Christ. You can see it all spelled out in Romans 6, 1 through 11. That was the epistle text for the last weekend before we're recording this. That's the language. You're remembering your baptism, remembering your identity is wrapped up in who Jesus says you are, not in anything else.
Yeah, this is Paul's argument in, you know, Romans 6, where he basically implores us to live in our baptism, which then he says is the same as living in our death, which is Christ's death.
That's right. We are united to him in his death there. And so Jesus then gives his reasons for why he says what he says. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in his glory, and the glory of the Father and of the holy angels. But I tell you truly, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God.
Now, one thing that's important as you look at Jesus' words here is that for the people that he's talking to directly here, this losing of their life is very literal. I mean, you're talking to a bunch of future martyrs, right? And so while Jesus has this, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me, there's an application to us, to be sure, which we just spelled out. Like, we're not all going to be martyrs.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't all have to go seeking a death. Like, you know, I need to go die for Jesus somewhere and, you know, make sure that someone kills me for my faith or something. That there's a death that we must do, which is a death to self. However, What they have also is this, look, there's an actual day coming for these men where they will be asked life on the line whether or not they will affirm this faith.
Yeah, it's a very real picture, even if they don't know it quite yet, even if they haven't experienced the persecution that will come, it's a very real threat to them in the near future.
Right. And so this is why, you know, he says that there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God.
In some ways, what we're going to see is it's a great contrast, because you have first the great confession from Peter, you're the Christ of God. Then you have sort of what sounds almost like this kind of downer section from Jesus, a surprising section where he's going, death and persecution and trials, those things are coming if you're following me. Those things are coming for me. And so, but now Jesus is going to go back and say, but don't worry, I am who you think I am. Like, I am actually divine. And he's going to show it now in verse 28. Now, about 8 days after these sayings, he took with him Peter and John and James, that's his inner circle, and went up on the mountain to pray. And as he was praying, the appearance of his face was altered and his clothing became dazzling white. And behold, two men were talking with him, Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Now, we should probably stop there, because there's already a lot of very interesting things here. Number one, clearly he appears to them in a divine state. That's what's meant to be pictured for us. His face was altered and his clothing became dazzling white. This is clearly meant to evoke a supernatural image in their minds, and for that matter, in our minds. Jesus, his divinity is being clearly shown here. On the other hand, his divinity is being clearly shown here also because of the people that show up with him.
Yeah.
You have Moses, who represents the law. You have Elijah, who represents the prophets. And both of them are speaking there to him about one thing, his departure, which in Greek, the word literally is his exodus.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so
the thing that's the topic of conversation is this very death and resurrection that he's going to go through. This is the big idea.
Yeah, and obviously these, Moses and Elijah are there to affirm that Jesus is indeed the fulfillment of both the law and the prophets.
That's right. So we come to verse 32. Now Peter and those who were with him were heavy with sleep, but when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. And as the men were parting from him, Peter said to Jesus, "Master, it is good that we are here. Let us make three tents, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah," not knowing what he said. I love that, not knowing what he said. Now, I think my belief is that the reason that Peter wants this is because Peter is liking what he's seeing. He likes this stage of glory and wants to stay there.
Oh yeah, yeah. This is look at all this glory. We'll set up camp right here.
Yeah.
We'll make three tents, and literally like three little tabernacles for you guys, and we'll do it this way. Part of the reason that he doesn't know what he's saying is that, look, the law and the prophets are over, man. We're not building houses for these things anymore. Like, they are there to affirm that this man before you is the fulfillment of all things, and we're not building dwelling places for Moses and Elijah, man.
Well, this is, part of the problem here is that he gives the three of them equal weight,
right,
in this, and they're not equal weight. Jesus is the fulfillment, and so if you really wanted to be right about this, it would make sense if he said, "Let me build one tabernacle for you, Jesus." Because Moses and Elijah are bowing down to you too.
Right.
Yeah. And as he was saying these things, a cloud came and overshadowed them, and they were afraid as they entered the cloud. Now, this is, of course, imagery that goes back to Mount Sinai. This goes back to the Israelites wandering in the desert during the Exodus account, where God shows up in a cloud in their midst. This is clearly the presence of the Father. And a voice came out of the cloud saying, "This is my Son, my chosen one, and here's the key. Listen to him." Not them, him.
Yeah, and this chosen one is, again, this. You could easily say, "This is my Son, the Christ."
That's right. This is God saying, I mean, you talk about Jesus had said just a little bit before, there are some here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God. Now they're seeing the kingdom of God. It's being revealed. And what God is saying is, everything that he's saying about his death and resurrection, about this Exodus, listen to that. Take note of that. Don't ignore that. And of course, they do ignore that. They don't process that. And that's the problem.
Yeah.
And when the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone. And they kept silent and told no one in those days anything of what they had seen.
Well, this seems consistent with Jesus' instructions over and over again. So for once, somebody listened.
But it had to be only after the Father shows up in a cloud, you know, and they're terrified, does it get through?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, we better not say anything. And of course, when you read the epistles later on from Peter and John, they will reference this event as one of the evidences for why you should believe what they have to say about their testimony of Jesus.
Yeah, I mean, John starts his gospel this way.
That's right. And Peter mentions it in his first epistle as well. And so now we come back down the mountain. They've just had this great, you know, sort of glorious experience on the mountaintop. What do they come back down to? Well, the reality of a fallen world. On the next day, when they come down from the mountain, a great crowd met him. And behold, a man from the crowd cried out, "Teacher, I beg you to look at my son, for he is my only child." And behold, a spirit seizes him, and he suddenly cries out. It convulses him so that he foams at the mouth and shatters him and will hardly leave him. And I begged your disciples to cast it out, but they could not. Jesus answered, "Oh, faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you and bear with you? Bring your son here." Now, let me just say, I don't think that this is Jesus rebuking the Father at all. And from the other accounts of this story, as a matter of fact, this is the story where Jesus says to the Father, this is the same account, but Luke doesn't include it. He says, "All things are possible if you believe." And the Father says, "I believe, help my unbelief." So the Father has this great confession. "I believe, help my unbelief."
Yeah.
And Jesus says, "Bring your son here."
Yeah, it's interesting that you see this sort of, this is not a rebuke, this is a lament. That's the tone that is struck here, to me in a way, that, "Oh, faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be here with you and bear with you?" He is mourning and lamenting the fact that this is the state of affairs. Mm-hmm. There's no faith. Mm-hmm. There's no trust in God in this generation to be found. There isn't a sense of anger, at least, that I pick up on.
No, I don't think so at all either. And Jesus, of course, even though this man confesses that he's got unbelief, this man does confess in the other accounts that he wishes he believed more, but he's still got some struggle and some doubt. Jesus says, "Bring your son here." And verse 42, it says, "While he was coming, the demon threw him to the ground and convulsed him. But Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit and healed the boy and gave him back to his father. And all were astonished at the majesty of God."
Now think about all the times in your life where you think that you've lacked faith and what you think it would be, you know, what you think God could do to increase your faith. Now, maybe you would think that if Jesus was walking the earth with you, took you up on a mountain, appeared with Moses and Elijah, the Father showed up in a cloud, you heard his voice come down from heaven, you would feel like this was a fairly big faith-bolstering moment.
Uh-huh.
Immediately following that encounter, is this encounter where the disciples cannot cast out a devil.
Yeah.
How much are the disciples really believing at this point? I mean, they got to be like just high on the faith, man. Yeah. I mean, they got to be they just came off the literal mountaintop of faith, right? I mean, so they're ready to go. Doesn't happen.
No. And, you know, of course, if there's a point of application that I think of in my own life, it's how quickly I can go in the same direction, that I can have these great sort of mountaintop experiences. I can have these great moments of intimacy with God. And oh my gosh, it doesn't take but a day of being back in real life that I can forget all about it, man.
Yeah. And I think what it really shows you is that whatever spiritual experience that you've had, look, you can't do jack without Jesus.
I think that should be our new slogan.
You can't do jack without Jesus. That's what it is, man.
Printed up on the t-shirt. We're selling them this year.
Because this is the only explanation for this, is that the disciples went down there and they tried to, they're like, I got this. I'll be giving it a shot. And, you know, Peter rolls up and be like, I'll cast this thing out. I just came off the mountain after all. And what you find is that Jesus is the only source of any kind of deliverance whatsoever.
And this is still the case, by the way.
Yeah.
No matter how much of an impressive preacher one may be, no matter how much of an impressive church it may be, if it lacks Jesus, it lacks the power.
Exactly.
If it lacks the gospel, it lacks the power. So now, so again, here's this whole passage is a passage of contrast, man. I mean, so you've got these glorious moments where Jesus is glorified and they're seeing him in his divine state, contrasted with his earlier prediction of death and hard times. And then you have him heal this boy who's been demon-possessed. But then again, but while they were all marveling at everything he was doing, Jesus said to his disciples, let these words sink into your ears. Again, this is my son. Listen to him. What does he have to say? The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men. Now, what a contrast, because clearly he can stop himself from being delivered into the hands of men. He's just expelled a demon. He doesn't have to be. But he chooses to be for the salvation of the world.
You know,
and what does it say? They did not understand this saying.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it seems that there's all kinds of things that they don't understand. I mean, they're marveling at what he's doing. And then Jesus says, let these words, I love this, like, let them sink into your ears. Like, I mean, like, apparently they've been bouncing off those calloused ears. Like, let this.
Dude, it reminds me of when I talk to my kids, like, let this sink in. Listen to your father.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, this is where, I'm reminded of Chris Tucker talking to Jackie Chan in Rush Hour. Do you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth?
I guarantee you that's the first ever reference to Rush Hour when going over this passage.
Probably,
in history.
I'd imagine it is. So, yeah, man, and he says, let these words sink into your ears. The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men. I mean, because they keep thinking, like, this is it. Like, oh, my gosh. Like, we just had the mountaintop thing, and that was a little confusing because, you know, Moses and Elijah were there, but then they weren't. But then we heard the voice of our Father and told us to listen to this guy. Then we came down, couldn't cast out this devil. That was kind of discouraging. But then Jesus rolls in and does the job. We are ready to go. And Jesus just squashes all of this, but they're just marveling about everything he's doing. He's like, look, I'm going to die.
And it's, again, they didn't understand the saying, and it was concealed from them so that they might not perceive it, and they were afraid to ask him about this saying. So they still don't get it. They can't process it. And then to add insult to injury here, again, you see the disciples. How much do they not get it? Verse 46, and an argument arose among them as to which of them was the greatest. I mean, it's amazing. This is, again, they're just missing the point. But Jesus, knowing the reasoning of their hearts, took a child and put him by his side and said to them, whoever receives this child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives him who sent me. For he who is least among you all is the one who is great. Let these words sink in. Do you hear the words coming out of my mouth?
Yeah, dude. I mean, basically all of Jesus' words are like, all of this is completely the opposite of what you think. This entire thing is upside down. The least is the greatest. I've got to die so that the world can live. All of this stuff, the rich are the poor. all of this. And what it is the great reversal of everything that Jesus has come to do. Die, like, lose your life, you'll save it. Save your life, you'll lose it. And you're like, what kind of riddles are this? And I think that, like, this is sort of one of the reasons where it says that it was concealed from him, you know, from them. Mm-hmm. The only explanation for that, because these words are not hard to understand. Yeah. I'm going to die.
Yeah.
Like, the only way to do it is, like, what do you think he means? So, yeah. Like, they're probably having, like, these deep conversations then about, like, so he says he's going to die, but what do you think he means by it?
Yeah.
And, like, there's
some... But anyway, who do you think is going to be the greatest?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's obviously some deeper meaning about this death thing. Yeah.
But more importantly, who's going to be the best?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And this is the state the disciples find themselves in. And man, it doesn't seem all that unfamiliar.
No, this is, unfortunately, we're prone to having the same sort of blindness and deafness to the words of Jesus and to the way of his kingdom. And so this is why the disciple of Jesus is picking up his cross daily and remembering who they are in their baptism, where they died with Christ and have been raised with Christ, because we haven't still figured it all out, Dan.
Yeah. We are out of time. Guys, if you would like to support the podcast, you can do so by going over to 1517.org/donate, and you can become a contributor. Thank you so much to those of you who do that. Guys, register for the city events. If you're in Europe, come see us in Germany and Sweden. We'd love to hang out with you. Eric,
rate and review the podcast on iTunes. Please.
Rate and review. We'd love to have those ratings and reviews. Makes everything more visible. Eric, I'll see you next week.
All right. Sounds good.